I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
You're listening to the Alonement Podcast. I'm your host, Francesca Spector, and this show is all about your longest and most important relationship,
the one you have with yourself. It doesn't matter if you're single, married, or somewhere in between. Alonement means valuing your time alone, regardless of your romantic status. Each week, I ask a new guest about the time they spend by themselves and why it matters.
My guest this week is writer and magazine editor Alexandra Shulman.
I think it's one of the great talents in life to be happy on your own. I think if people who are content on their own, who also can relate to other people, I mean, you know, they are... Yeah, that is a great talent because, you know, at the end of the day, we are on our own, really, and it's very important to be able to be on your own.
Alexandra Shulman is best known for being the former editor-in-chief of British Vogue, where she was at the helm for 25 years, the longest-serving editor in the publication's history. This is also a rather special interview for me because Alexandra is my former boss. I began my journalistic career as an intern at British Vogue 6 years ago. As well as a magazine editor, Alexandra is a novelist and non-fiction author. Her most recent book, a memoir titled Clothes and Other Things That Matter, is a fascinating insight into Alexandra's career at Vogue and beyond. Alexandra, hi.
Hi.
Firstly, can I just say how honoured I am to have you on the podcast? I will always remember the first time we met because I was an intern at British Vogue for 6 months. And I remember, I think it was, you know, my first couple of weeks in, you came over and introduced yourself and you asked me which version of the magazine cover I preferred because there were two different versions. And yeah, I will always remember that as a first meeting. I think it really blew all sort of Devil Wears Prada connotations out of the window.
Oh, that's so nice you remember that. I did that quite often, asking people because, you know, you have your own personal view. And normally I did what I wanted, you know, when it was a choice. But it's quite good to test out, particularly people who were like interns who were coming into the office, who weren't part of the culture, who didn't have any kind of allegiances to anyone, so that, you know, their opinion was completely sort of fair in a way. So I'm pleased you liked it.
I did. It was just very welcoming. I can't even imagine what it would be like being the final word with that kind of thing. Did that take quite a few years to develop that sense of what would work?
No, I think I've always been very opinionated. Even as a child, I think, you know, the one thing I've always thought that as an editor, the important thing was to be able to make a decision that people really like to be told one thing or the other and not to kind of dither about it. So, but opinions, I don't know, I've always had opinions.
Okay, so clearly independent thinking has never been a problem for you. How about spending time physically alone? What's your relationship with that been like over the years?
Well, it's an interesting question. I didn't spend much time on my own, obviously, as a child. You know, we lived in a flat with, there were three kids and my parents, and there was no sort of never anywhere to be on your own. And so I guess my first experience really of being on my own was going to university and, you know, being in, you know, your university room on your own. And I liked that, but I sort of, I don't think I'm somebody who loves being on my own. I like it selectively. I like to be alone to do what I want to do and knowing that there's going to be somebody else coming back or that I'm going to see afterwards. I mean, I think that's a really the nicest thing is to be able to kind of do your own thing, have your own life, but then to be able to share it in some way with someone at some point.
So you were at the helm of British Vogue for 25 years. How did you cope with the showbiz element of that? So the big parties and meeting celebrities. Was that a part of the job that you enjoyed doing?
No, I'm very, very bad with famous people. I'm completely silenced by anybody famous, always have been. And I remember actually one day I was flying to New York I was lucky enough that I was flying first class and opposite me, Benedict Cumberbatch got on the plane in the seat opposite. And, you know, I thought, oh God, nobody wants to be, you know, noticed or recognized or whatever. So, you know, I wasn't saying anything. And then he very sweetly offered me a mint when we were taking off. So, you know, I said, oh, thank you, that's really, really nice. And then he kind of went to sleep for the journey, and I'm scared of flying, so I didn't sleep at all. You know, I was awake for 8 hours or whatever. And then just before we landed in New York, he woke up, and I think he must have said something or something, and I just couldn't think what to say to him. I remember, you know, I said something like, oh, is that your breakfast you're ordering? Or something really kind of stupid. And I just completely did not know what to say. And then when I got back to the office and I was telling people the story, they were just like, we cannot believe you're so lame, you know, that was all you could say to Benedict Cumberbatch.
So starstruck by Benedict Cumberbatch. And how long had you been editor of British Vogue at that point?
Oh, about 23 years.
So it sort of never goes.
No.
And how about the social element of all that? So I remember there were some fabulous Vogue parties. Did you consciously try and dip out of the limelight with those?
No, I love giving parties. That was, you know, that was great. And I mean, I think the thing about famous people is that everybody else likes to have them around. It makes everybody feel that they're somewhere special to be in the company of people who are famous. So, you know, for Vogue parties, that was very, very important. Because it kind of added to the fun of it. But for me personally, you know, I didn't really feel anything about it.
So your new book, Clothes and Other Things That Matter, it talks about how your own wardrobe has played a role in your life and what different items of clothing have meant to you over the years. We're recording during the coronavirus lockdown, when many of us aren't really leaving our houses. What role do you think clothes play at the moment?
I think what's been really interesting during this period is we're all alone right now. I mean, not some people, you know, people like me luckily live with other people, but there are many people who are on their own. And I think it's been very interesting to see how people feel about their clothes in this situation when really either nobody else is seeing them or just the people who know them really well are seeing them, and the people to whom it matters to kind of get dressed in the morning and to think about what you're wearing and that sort of part of your routine, your kind of strategy makes you feel good, whereas other people feel that this is a time when they can just kind of just not bother and they want to sign off on the whole kind of clothes thing. And I mean, I don't think there's any right or wrong about it, but I think it is interesting seeing how different people have reacted.
Yeah, I mean, that really resonates because I've been isolating alone.
How long have you been on your own?
I think about 35 days or something. I mean, I don't have a wall chart, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, quite a while. I really surprised myself, though, because I expected to really not care about what I was wearing during this time. But, you know, psychologically, it does affect me and it does make me feel a certain way. If I'm in my pajamas compared to if I'm properly dressed. And yeah, I think it's really interesting that clothing affects your sort of sense of identity that much.
Well, clothes are very, they touch you. You wear your clothes. They're on your body. They're on your skin. They're completely part of you. And I think that's one of the reasons why they have such kind of potency. They're not really an adjunct. And I think they're not important to everybody. Not everybody thinks they're important. I think even the fact that somebody doesn't think they're important actually tells you something about them. I think you can read a lot about people through their clothes. But days like this, times like this, it's very interesting about, I guess, what people do to make themselves feel safe or to make themselves feel happy or to make themselves feel that times aren't that strange.
How about for you in your earlier career when you first became editor of British Vogue? Did you feel like you had to dress a certain way? Was there a certain amount of, I don't think anyone feels ever ready to become the editor of Vogue, but was there a certain amount of faking it to make it in the way that you dressed?
No, not really. Clothes didn't. I think when I became editor of Vogue, I was quite aware of the fact that the clothes that I owned and the way I dressed wasn't probably the way that most people who would edit Vogue would, because I came from a different kind of, I'd been a general features journalist, and previous to editing Vogue, I'd edited GQ, so that was a men's magazine. And before that, I was a more like an arts and general journalist. And so fashion per se and kind of trends and things like that wasn't that I was unaware of them, and it certainly wasn't that I was uninterested in them, but my wardrobe wasn't dictated in any way by them. And I think I was quite keen to try and hold on to that, the way I dressed, as part of myself, rather than to try and become something that I thought was part of the job. I thought it was very important because, as you say, it's an amazing job. And I never thought I would become editor of Vogue, but I wanted to make sure that I didn't try to be something that I didn't feel was naturally me. So, and my clothes, I think, were a part of that. I mean, obviously, there were times when, I was lucky enough to have wonderful clothes and access to great clothes. And of course, I became very, very aware of what was what was fashionable, what was trendy, who was the most interesting designer and things like that. But I think I was always maybe just like slightly distance, one step removed from it, actually, personally.
How has your distinctive dress sense changed since you left Vogue?
Being in an office, I don't think my style has changed very much because that was the whole thing, is I kept to my own thing. But obviously, I feel a bit more playful about my clothes. I think I'm more prepared to take a risk with things because it's just easier to do it when you're not walking into an office of 40 beautifully dressed people and you're not wandering around being a kind of exemplar of an idea like Vogue. It's kind of easier to go out there and wear something that people are going to think, not sure that works. Doesn't matter now. Yeah, I didn't have a uniform, but I think I'm probably more prepared to try things out. There's a freedom. It's a freedom, let's put it that way.
Okay, and while you were editing Vogue, I don't know how you found the time, but you also wrote two different novels. How did you find the experience of writing a novel, which, in contrast to editing a magazine, is a very solitary experience?
Well, because I was editing Vogue when I wrote the novels, I had limited amount of time that I could write, and I'm anyway somebody that can't write. I mean, I'm not somebody who'll sit down all day and try and write. I can only work in the morning. So I kind of allocated time, and I just took that view, which was that you can't wait for inspiration. You can't wait to feel like writing. You have to sit down at the time you say you're going to sit down. And if you get 3 words done, you get 3 words done. If you get 500 words done, you get 500 words done. They may be rubbish words, but you can redo them the next day. The important thing is to sit down and do it. So I used to do that in the mornings, got up quite early.
How early? I mean, that must have been quite early in the morning before work.
Sometimes about 5 o'clock, 6 would be more likely to write. So just get up, go downstairs, make a big pot of coffee, and sort of that would be like 6-ish. So I'd write till about 7:30 and then re-engage with everyone else getting up. By the time I started writing books, my son was kind of, you know, able to get himself up and going and everything. So I'd probably do like maybe an hour or so in the morning before going to work. But it's lovely. I love that early morning when you are on your own and there's nobody else around. And that's, I think, a really lovely time of the day. And then I used to take Friday lunch hour and go to a library and work. It was like the end of the day. I couldn't do it every day because I was immersed in Vogue. But I thought Friday, end of the week, I can take my lunch hour. And I went to the London Library, where I'm now a vice president. And I go and sit there for a couple of hours, actually, and write. And then I wrote every weekend. So, but not kind of, you know, I don't sit there. Like, I know many people who will write and they just sit there, and it was like blanket stitch. I'd write stuff and then rewrite it the next day and rewrite it the next day, you know, just getting a little bit further on.
You know, I think it's really interesting to hear your process, because I think a lot of people will say, you know, they want to write a book, but they can't because they have a full-time job. And if they were to write a book, they'd want to have a big chunk of time to devote themselves to their art. But I guess what you're saying is that for you, that wouldn't have worked, that you didn't want to just focus solely on writing a novel, that, you know, you liked balancing the two, and that sort of helped you along.
Yeah, well, I would have found it very hard to be, people kept saying, oh, are you gonna, you know, why don't you go off for a week on your own and have a bash, you know, at the book or whatever. And it was like the last thing in the world I wanted to do was to isolate myself somewhere and have all day, every day and all night when I could be writing. It absolutely hated that idea. But, you know, having said which, you know, I'm not Proust. I'm not Anne Tyler. You know, I haven't written brilliant novels. And it may be that if you're going to write something really brilliant, maybe you have to be somebody that can allow themselves to be more in that cocoon. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. The thing about novel, I mean, particularly second novel, The Parrots, I really enjoyed being with the people that I had created. And, you know, I was really interested to see what happened to them. And that's very exciting about fiction writing, I think, that, you know, sometimes people turn into things that you didn't expect, or things happen that you never thought were going to happen. And you do need a bit of space for that to happen, I think. But yeah, I mean, one time that I did actually decide I was going to go, and I was trying to finish The Parrots, and I had a few days holiday. So I went to Spain, to the south of Spain, to a beautiful place. And I was going to be there for kind of a week on my own. And I remember I got the train from Barcelona to Madrid, and then another train I was going to take. And then I left the laptop on the train in Madrid with my novel on it that was not backed up. And that was like one of the worst moments I've ever had in my life. I mean, I did literally, I called such pandemonium in Madrid central train station that I got somebody to kind of open the gates and let me run onto the train. And I found it because luckily it was sort of, you know, yeah, but it was like, you know, worst half hour of my life because it wasn't backed up. And
oh my God. I mean, I can only imagine. I'm sure that put you off.
Yeah, yeah, it did. It took me days to recover.
So what does your writing process look like now? I imagine you have a lot more time to focus.
Well, I do a column for the Mail on Sunday. And so that sort of, I get up. I have a quite a routine about that. I do it on 2 days, and you know, I have specific times that I'm quite rigid about that. And that's very nice for me because it's like a kind of pillar to my week when I know exactly what I'm going to be doing. And I sit in this room where I'm sitting now, which is my office, at my desk here. And write. And then any other with the book, basically sat here and wrote it too. Sometimes I sit downstairs at the kitchen table and write, but that's only if there's no one else in the house. I quite like being in this room. It's like a kind of, it's a workspace, so I'm not tempted to do something else.
So not only did you write multiple novels during your time at Vogue, you also became a mother to your son, Samuel Spike, with your now ex-husband, Paul Spike. You speak really honestly in what I think is one of my favourite chapters of the book about how you had a very successful career, but at the age of 35, you felt the ticking of a biological clock that no career success could silence. As someone who ostensibly was able to go on and have it all, what advice would you give to women in the same position trying to balance those competing priorities?
I don't think you can have it all. I mean, maybe the odd, very odd person has it all, but I think I was very lucky. You know, I had Sam. I got many friends who haven't had children, who, not because they were too busy working or anything, just because they never, you know, really found the right person to have a child with. And I think one of the things that, if you're working, certainly when I was in my 30s, was there would be a lot of people who would be saying, oh, you know, you're such a career girl. I don't suppose you've got the time to have a child, or, you know, is your career more important to you? And I really minded that, because that was never, you know, that was never the way that I felt. I just wasn't going to have a child unless I felt I was in the right circumstances with somebody to have a child with them. And it's interesting now with, you know, people freezing their eggs, and people have, you know, that the idea of sort of conception of a child's really changed a lot since then. And I don't know what decision I would have made, you know, had I now, whether I would have thought about having a child on my own more or something. But in terms of having a child and having a big job, you know, you just get on with it, really. I mean, I only had one child. I did have my stepdaughter, Emma, came to live with her father, Paul, and me when she was 12. So I had a kind of a 12-year-old for 10 years till she was about 22 as well. So there were sort of two children in the house, because her brother was older, didn't live with me full time. But it's not like having, you know, not like Helena Morrissey with whatever, she's got 9 children or something.
Yeah, I imagine 9 is quite a handful. You did then become a single parent, though, when you and Samuel's father were divorced in 2005. Was that difficult, being the sole carer for, I think Samuel must have been about 10, when you were still at the helm of Vogue?
I think I was very lucky that I had a great job, because obviously that financially enabled me to look after my child. And also I had something so sort of wonderful to spend my time doing. It's not easy being on your own with a child or you know, more than one child. I think I would have found it much, much harder if I'd had two children. I mean, it was, you know, if you've just got one child and you're in that position, you become a kind of a quite mobile unit. You know, people, they can have you to stay and you can just take up one bedroom, or you can go somewhere and you just need to rent one hotel room, and you can get, you know, traveling's easier, all of that. I was very aware of that. But I don't think, you know, it's not easy being on your own and doing a job, and it's not easy being on your own and not doing a job, actually.
Obviously, this is a podcast about the value of being alone, but I also really like to have discussions of loneliness because, you know, there are two sides to the coin. When you were the editor of Vogue, cliche is that it's lonely at the top, but was it? Did you ever feel lonely during your time there?
No, I was never lonely at Vogue. I was, I have fantastic family and I have fantastic friends, and I had many, many wonderful colleagues who I was close to. But I never expected my colleagues to be my friends. And that was very helpful in a way, because I think sometimes people kind of mistake work relationships for friendship. And therefore when things get difficult at work, then both parties can kind of feel a betrayal. So it's quite good to keep them separate. No, I never felt lonely. I mean, sometimes you'd have a difficult decision to make and you couldn't really talk to anybody about it and just had to make the decision. And that was what I was paid for.
So I guess that it was a professional value of yours, not to get the professional and personal confused.
Yeah.
How about socializing outside of work hours? Were you wary of that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, some of the... I'm just trying to think. I mean, over the years, there have been people on the team that obviously I was closer to than others. Some people I knew before I came to Vogue, and I brought them into Vogue. So I was seeing them outside of work hours before, and I carried on seeing them. But I think it's kind of like you don't feel, you know, like everyone's going to the pub on a Friday night, and you don't kind of, I always felt, well, it's nicer for them if I'm not going along, you know, it's kind of like, this is them to let their hair down or whatever. It's kind of nicer for people if you're not there.
And do you still keep in touch with many of your former Vogue colleagues?
Yeah, quite a few, less so the ones that are still there. But a lot of people left when I left. And so, yeah, I do keep in touch with them. I mean, I think, you know, from the point of view of alonement, one of the interesting things is, you know, I've lived all my life working in an office with other people around me. And this has really been the first time since I've been an adult when I haven't had loads of people around me all the time. And, you know, a lot of people who do jobs where they're running big things and their days are immersed with people find that very hard to adjust to. But I've never felt bereft at not having the company around me all the time, which I thought maybe I would.
Yeah. Although obviously I remember the layout, you had your own office, whereas a lot of it was open plan. Do you think that part of why you don't mind it so much now is because you were used to having your own space?
Maybe, but the people that I know that have minded it over the years, you know, when they changed jobs or, you know, or left it, many of them had their own offices as well. I think it's more to do with how much you feel that the company or the interaction with other people is something that makes you feel more validated. I mean, I don't like a day if there aren't many emails. I like emails. I like text messages. I like telephone calls. But that thing of constantly being surrounded by people, I don't miss that at all.
So you're kind of happy with having the virtual buzz of people around?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's quite a lockdown-proof mentality.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I mean, I keep thinking how lucky, if coronavirus was going to happen, how lucky it is that it happened now, not 10 years before, when we wouldn't have had all these digital tools, you know, Zoom and Skype and FaceTime and Squadcast that you're using.
Yeah, this podcast would not be happening 10 years ago. I mean, I guess there weren't any podcasts 10 years ago, but still.
No.
So as we've spoken about, we're in the midst of coronavirus lockdown at the moment. How are you finding isolating now with your partner, David?
It's absolutely fine. We're lucky. We've got a garden, got a park outside the front of the house. I go for a run. So I get out. He goes out for a walk. We've both got our own offices here. So it's been completely fine, I have to say. I mean, it's only been, 3 weeks or something now. I'm not sure another 3 weeks what it'll feel like. But I think, you know, I've been so far very lucky. Nobody I know has been really, really sick. I know a lot of people who have been ill, but nobody that's been dangerously, or one person who is dangerously ill, but I only knew that once they'd recovered. And in a way, I've always got so many things that I want to do that this has given you some space to be able to. Funny enough, everyone's saying it's harder to read than you'd think it was, that everyone's like, you think, I've got all these books I want to read, and then you sit down to read and then you kind of don't. But things like tidying things out and doing a jigsaw puzzle, I'm a bit obsessed with that at the moment, and cooking, lots of cooking going on, making lists, endless lists, things to do, the now, what, not now, when kind of things, like, you know, your photograph albums.
I mean, I think before we could hypothetically say, if I had all the time in the world, I'd do X, and now we actually do.
Yeah.
And have you learnt anything surprising about yourself during this time?
That's a good question. I think I've learnt that when it's something like as big as this, that I find it slightly less anxiety inducing as kind of smaller, more personal things. I mean, a lot of people I know are sort of waking up in the night worried, or, and obviously, you know, I, like everybody, am worried on a certain level. And, you know, one is worried about what's going to happen to the economy. One is worried about what's going to happen with work. One is worried about the health of other people. But I think I've been surprised at how that hasn't been as bad as I thought it might have been. And, you know, isolation, it's odd when you say you've been isolating, because I don't really feel like it's that isolating somehow, because I don't know why. It just doesn't seem, you know what, because the book was coming out and I had this incredibly busy schedule of activity, festivals, talks, all of that, and it's all in my, on my laptop, in my calendar there. And it's kind of strange because it's like this kind of ghost world. I've kept it there, even though none of it's happening. And it's kind of strange feeling that there's all that activity that should have been happening that isn't going to happen now. But then in a way, if you've got a book coming out and it becomes quite time consuming doing all the things around it that now you have to do that other people might have done before. So I don't feel so, in a way, so I'm spending so much time thinking about the book that it doesn't feel quite like I'm isolating. I can't explain.
I'm curious, do you think you could cope with isolating alone right now?
What, like you, 35 days? I don't think so. I would not have been happy, no. I would find that very difficult.
But you have had times in your life where you have lived alone.
Yeah, I lived on my own. I reckon from about the age of 27 to about 35, I lived on my own. So quite a long time.
But you wouldn't want to do it now?
Well, isolated is different because you're not seeing other people. When I lived on my own, I had people to dinner. I went out to dinner, go to parties. That's a totally different thing to being self-isolated.
Do you think that time between the age of 27 to 35 that you lived alone, do you think that helped you to work on that independence?
I don't really know the answer to that, actually. I think that sort of not how life works. You just kind of, when you're on your own, you're on your own. And then if somebody else is living with you, well, then they're there. And then if you've got a child, then they're there. And you're not, I never was very aware of those things changing. But I think now, having spent all these years living with other people, should I find myself living on my own, that would be quite a big readjustment. I think it's one of the great talents in life is to be happy on your own. I think if people who are content on their own, who also can relate to other people, that is a great talent because, at the end of the day, we are on our own, really, and it's very important to be able to be on your own. And I think it's also something that maybe we don't value enough, that ability to be on your own. It's a kind of skill that's worth trying to perfect, I think.
Alexandra, thank you so much for speaking to me.
That's okay.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the Alonement Podcast. And thank you so much to my guest, Alexandra Shulman. If you liked this episode, please do rate, review, or subscribe. It makes a big difference to helping other people find us. Until next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.